This is The Guardian.
I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story, Newsroom Edition, where Guardian Australia's editors discuss the news of the week. The pandemic has deepened a crisis of care in our society.
It is not good enough. The crisis is here. The crisis is now. The solution needs to be now.
The aged care sector is reeling from the impact of Omicron as providers struggle to fill chronic staff shortages and workers fight for an increase in pay and better conditions.
Prime Minister, come and work a day in aged care. Come and see what our members do every single day, and you will understand why you need to support the increased wages.
In the middle of their own battle for increased pay and improved staff-to-patient ratios, nurses across New South Wales have voted to walk out.
Why are they doing this? Well, the Nurses and Midwives Union says their members are at breaking point, they are fed up, and they feel they are being ignored.
And families across the country continue to go without childcare as staff in that sector face similar struggles over COVID, conditions and wages.
Being warned the sudden closures many have experienced during the Omicron wave could continue long after the variant's peak.
Today, I'm talking to Editor-in-Chief Lenore Taylor and Head of News Mike Tisher about why we pay the least for the jobs we value most. It's Friday, the 11th of February. Good morning, Lenore.
Morning, Gabs.
Morning, Mike.
Good morning.
So we seem to have been faced with a lot of very disaffected care workers this week, Lenore. Has something changed, or is this just a result of the ongoing pandemic?
I think the problem is nothing has changed. I think that's part of the long-standing systemic issues that revolve around really low pay primarily, and in some cases also staffing numbers and how well they can possibly do a caring role with so few workers per people they're supposed to be caring for. And the pandemic has just sort of come on top of all of that and really exposed these issues in a way that is terrible for the workers, but also confronting for the rest of the population when we realise that these people who we really rely on so heavily for really essential services are so undervalued that it's really exacerbating the pandemic crisis. So I think it means the real problem is that what hasn't changed is a proper discussion about how well we value people who do really important caring work.
Why don't we start with aged care workers? What are the major problems with that workforce?
So I think, I mean, there are a lot of things that are common to all these workforces, more or less. They're largely female-dominated. They are often very heavily casualised. Many of them are staffed, in a lot of cases, by recent migrants to Australia, in some cases, all of which makes it difficult to unionise. It's always difficult to threaten industrial action in care settings. No one wants to think about going on strike if you're a nurse or an aged care worker, because obviously you're leaving the people you care for. So I think for all those reasons have played in to one extent or another into their pay and conditions. So there's just a whole raft of issues that result from these career paths being undervalued. We have never really got hold of this issue in terms of valuing these professions properly. And the pandemic has obviously exposed all that even more so than before.
As you both said, we've known that there's a problem with wages in care workforces for a long time. But just sticking on aged care workers for a while, Lenore, the government seems to have noticed that it's an issue and they've offered some $400 retention payments. What do you think's going on there?
Well, I mean, just to go back to the first part of your question about knowing for a long time, I mean, we had an Aged Care Royal Commission and it quite clearly set out the problems with pay and staffing ratios in aged care homes. They said they were too low for people to really be offered care. Not enough has changed about that. And you're right, the pandemic has just made it vastly worse. But in terms of those structural things, not much is happening. So our reporter, Sarah Martin, has written a story this week about six aged care peak bodies writing an open letter to Scott Morrison urging him to do something about the crisis in the aged care sector, which, you know, we have to remember, I think nearly 600 elderly Australians have died since the beginning of the year. Mm. And really the care in aged care is so poor that the government has been forced to send in the armed forces to help out in aged care settings. This group of six aged care peak bodies have said there were fundamental issues which were cracks in the aged care system before, and now they're turning into chasms by the pandemic. The government has set up a task force. They had a report, and this was another story that Sarah wrote this week, that they had a report on the state of the aged care workforce, which they're sitting on. So those kind of structural issues are going unaddressed. But in order to be seen to be doing something, they have, as you say, offered a bonus, like a one-off or in two parts bonus to aged care workers. And I think the workers are saying, and I think this is quite true, that is sort of a band-aid measure. What they need is a permanent increase to their pay. Mm-hmm. That's before the Fair Work Commission at the moment, and the government has not supported the need for a pay rise before the Fair Work Commission.
And the Health Services Union did a survey and they found that 70% of voters support a 25% increase in wages for aged care workers, which is what they're arguing for at the Fair Work Commission. If it's that popular, why isn't the government doing something about it, Mike?
Well, obviously there's cost, you know, there's a cost to the budget. And I think just more generally on how far back this goes, we've known about the ageing population for a long time. The first intergenerational report was in 2002. There was a Productivity Commission report in 2004 about the ageing population. We've known about increased female participation in the workforce for decades. It's obviously, you know, this is not something that's happened in the last 2 years. But the problem is that all those questions have been treated as an economic problem, as a budget problem. You know, they've been treated as a budget line item. So it's been, you know, how come with the shrinking young workforce, an increasing elderly population who will need more healthcare, people are living longer, how do we make the budget square in that? Because we'll need more tax revenue from a smaller number of people. And generally the answer to that has been we need more migrants. And another answer has been that we need to limit the amount of money that we're spending on aged care and childcare. And that's exactly what they've done over many years, going right back to the Howard reforms in the late 90s.
And when you look, I mean, 25% sounds like a big amount in percentage terms, but I think aged care workers get something like $24 an hour. So in real terms, it's not huge. And we've been reading stories for years about aged care workers who can't afford secure housing or who have to take second and third jobs just to survive. And also, I kind of think about how it must feel to be a carer when you can't physically offer care. And when you're in a position of responsibility, and there are all these distressed old people who clearly aren't being cared for properly, and you can't physically do it because there's too few of you. And I know we discussed this in our news conference this week, and almost everybody in the meeting had some sort of personal experience of battling and struggling with the aged care system in some way with their family. I mean, it really is, I can't imagine what it would feel like to be responsible for a large number of old people who were in distress and just not being able to physically help them sufficiently.
Mm. Ran a story by one of our reporters, Amanda Mead, about the treatment her mother received in aged care a while ago, which was in a quite expensive care home but was nevertheless terrible. But the workers, who were Nepali background, I think, some of them came to her funeral after she died because they cared so much about her, but nevertheless were unable to provide the care. I mean, it was just absolutely heartbreaking.
And I have a family member who was in an aged care home until he died and, you know, really had a terrible experience. But his wife was reluctant to complain because she didn't want the workers to get into trouble because they were clearly doing the best that they possibly could in the circumstance. The problem was the staffing ratios were just woefully, totally inadequate to provide sufficient care.
And we know that some aged care providers are making huge profits, don't we? I mean, our reporting alone by Ben Butler and Melissa Davey in 2020 found that some of the for-profit companies were paying millions of dollars in dividends to their shareholders, even while the crisis was ongoing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they are. There's different parts of the system, right? There's sort of not-for-profit and for-profit aged care homes, some that are run by the state and some that are run by private business. So it's a complicated structure. But, yes, mm-hmm. some of them are making massive profits.
But it also typically, when we've looked at this, the conditions in the for-profit ones have been much worse. And we know the number of deaths in the for-profit ones have been much worse during the pandemic. So, yeah, something doesn't add up there.
So is part of the solution just better regulation, regulating like what money gets spent on that is given to aged care services?
Well, I think the Aged Care Royal Commission recommended a change to staffing ratios and a different regulatory system. And the government did adopt some of the recommendations and they've been gradually rolled through and they were to do with how the sector is administered and regulated. But the really important changes to staffing ratios and pay haven't really hit yet.
And it's not just aged care workers, is it? We know that, for example, disability care workers who face similarly tough conditions and low pay are not getting the $400 bonus payment. And we also heard this week that hospital nurses in New South Wales are going on strike for the first time in almost a decade. What are they saying the reason behind that is?
So, I mean, I think that this sort of comes back to the question about treating this as a budget item. Like in several states, there was a public sector wage freeze imposed in 2020 during the first days of the pandemic because so much money was being spent elsewhere to support workers. At the same time, these are the workers that we're absolutely depending on to get us through the pandemic. So I think there's probably still a lot of resentment about that among people who have been right at the sharp end of dealing with the pandemic and yet were the ones who specifically whose wages were held down by state governments during some of the worst days of the pandemic. And, you know, that's just exacerbated their long-standing complaints that their work is not valued highly enough in terms of pay. And, I mean, who could argue with that?
I would be interested to see how this plays out in the federal election campaign. I think, as I said, the government isn't supporting the pay case in the Fair Work Commission for aged care workers. Mm. Anthony Albanese has said he does support a pay rise and he's criticised the government for not intervening in the Fair Work hearings, but he hasn't said by how much and he hasn't said what else really that Labor would do for aged care other than that they would increase funding. So I do think the level of concern in the community, the Labor Party has used this as a sort of an attack line on the government this week in Parliament, indicates that it might well be a live issue in the election campaign. And I think a lot of Australians would hope that it is.
And there's also similar issues facing childcare workers. There were more reports this week that childcare workers are leaving in droves. What's that about?
Well, it's the same issue, different sector. Childcare workers get about $25 an hour and they're on the front line of the pandemic. And, you know, there's no free rats for childcare. Omicron is present in childcare centres. I read something this week that more than one in 10 childcare centres at the moment need a government waiver to legally operate because they don't have enough workers, the number of workers that they're required to have under the law. That's because a lot of workers are leaving. And also because a lot of workers are sick because pandemic is sweeping through the centres. I read a survey in 2021 which said that about 4,000 childcare workers or 73% said they planned to leave the job within 3 years because they felt undervalued, overworked and they didn't get enough pay. So it's exactly the same issues, the same sort of structural issues, just in a different sector. And again, you know, we hear and we read all the time about how the early years of a child's life are the most are so important educationally and developmentally, but we don't value the workers who are looking after them.
And again, this goes back well before the pandemic. I mean, this is not a new issue.
Yeah.
Jen Jackson from Victoria University wrote in The Conversation recently, the turnover of the workforce goes back well before the pandemic. And the same was true in a survey in 2016. She's made the point that the problem is that all the money that pays for them comes from various sources. So it's easy for each federal, state and private, you know, federal and state governments and private operators to pass the buck to one another when complaints are made about pay and nothing ever gets done. It's everyone's problem and no one's problem.
Which was interesting that Dominique Perrottet said in that speech a while back that he wanted the states and territories to take over responsibility for childcare from the federal government. which makes some sense to me, because I do think, as you say, Mike, that it needs to be integrated and integrated with schooling, because at the moment the federal government funds the subsidies for childcare providers, but the providers are mostly private. They set their own fees. The state and territory governments run preschools. I guess the structural issues and the funding issues are all so complex, and actually it sort of makes sense to me that if you had a clear overview of who paid for what, it might be easier to make the case for higher pay for workers and have the government subsidies flow through directly to that.
Mm. So as we've said, these are similar problems, different sectors, all essential services. We know that cost of living pressures are making it even harder for these low-paid workers. Does the government have a policy to fix this?
Keeping quiet about it if it does.
I mean, as I said, I think aged care is likely to be a contested issue at the next election. Governments of all persuasions have had several attempts at improving childcare and increasing subsidies to help families with childcare. They see it as a clear workforce participation issue, a real cost of living issue for families. But despite all the billions poured in, families still find it really difficult to afford childcare, and there are still these workforce issues. And I guess the nurses now are ready to strike. That'll be an issue with state governments, but, you know, I think that that's a live issue as well. And as Mike's been saying, I think it is ultimately a budget discussion, but it does seem to me that we're starting to talk about budget repair, as in reducing the overall levels of government spending. We're still talking about locking in another phase of very expensive personal tax cuts, which makes a structural difference to the budget. And we're talking about those things before we have a discussion about these fundamental services and how much we value them and how much we need to spend on them to give vulnerable members of our community the care that they deserve. And I guess to my mind, that's the discussion we should be having first.
Mm. It's not just about the intrinsic value of providing adequate care in aged care or childcare or disability care. That's obviously intrinsically a desirable thing, but it's also an economic question. Like, if we don't provide proper childcare, then it creates huge problems for people getting into the workforce. It's an extra drag on the economy. The childcare fees are so high, and obviously if you increase the subsidies, that sometimes just has the effect of putting up the fees and not actually making it easier for parents to pay for it. And it's not just a dignity and value question, it's also an economic question. There are economic benefits in providing services properly.
Next, three figures seen with new eyes. All right, now we come to what we can't get out of our head. Mike, I'm going to start with you today. What was it for you?
Well, strangely enough, it was Monica Lewinsky. I've been rewatching the excellent documentary series, The Clinton Affair, on SBS On Demand. And just the absolutely atrocious and unbelievable treatment of her in that period is quite shocking. It took her almost 20 years before she could kind of regain her agency and her public persona and really have her say on what happened and what she's doing with the rest of her life. And it just struck me, look, watching Grace Tame and Brittany Higgins at the National Press Club this week, that the allegations about what's happened in Parliament House and in some cases the terrible responses to them, as the Jenkins report, you know, found, and the difficulties that women have had in speaking up about, not just in Parliament but elsewhere, and obviously the situations are not completely comparable. There are very many differences, but there are also some similarities. And it struck me that we have made some progress. The conversation is more about power imbalances now, and women are not being blamed for everything now. And the speed with which Grace Tame and Brittany Higgins have been able to reclaim their narrative, I think, just tells us something quite positive from a very low base, admittedly, from the absolutely appalling way that Monica Lewinsky was treated.
Lenore, what could you not get out of your head?
Well, mine feels a little bit trivial now. But
yeah, welcome to my world.
But we have to have a laugh, right?
Yes.
So I was taken with a story about a security guard in a Russian art gallery on his first day on the job who got a little bit bored and decided that he'd draw two pairs of eyes on a painting worth more than $1 million with a ballpoint pen. Needless to say, this didn't go down so well. I'm not sure if he's still employed or not. And, yeah, the painting does not appear to have been enhanced by his art additions.
It's all in the eye of the beholder.
But, like, what? Surely it's sort of part of the job description, like, don't deface the paintings. I don't know.
It reminds me of the Eki Homo restorer who said, but I wasn't finished. Maybe he wasn't finished. Okay. Thank you very much, Lenore and Mike, for joining us today.
Thanks, Gabs.
Thanks a lot.
This episode was produced by Miles Herbert and Camilla Hannon. The executive producers are Miles Martignoni and me, Gabrielle Jackson. If you like Full Story and the Newsroom Edition, tell your friends about it or leave a rating and review. Laura Murphy Oates will be back with you on Monday and we'll see you then. I won't be here next week, but you will be in the very capable hands of Lucy Clark on the Friday show.